with my.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Remember the good old days, the 90s and the early 2000s? That's when the economy was just chugging along, growing at leaps and bounds. If you looked at the economy on a graph, the line just kept going up, 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 and the stock market was following a similar path. Back then, most of us didn't give the economy a second thought. Everything was good, and we were told that wasn't going to change. Then it did. Along came the Great Recession, and nothing has been the same since. True, the economy has recovered from the darkest days of that economic downturn, but the old glory days seem to be gone forever, and every day seems to bring more uncertainty. For instance, the Fed, which has been nursing our economy back to health, believed late last year that things had gotten good enough to start raising interest rates again. Jobs had recovered, growth, slow growth, seemed the order of the day. But oil prices plummeted, and along with it, the price of gasoline and heating oil. Good, you say? Well, not so fast. The stock market didn't like that one bit, and they seemed quite shaken by a slowdown in China. The result was the worst January, the worst start of a year in the market's history, and the worries continue. Even the Fed is looking over its shoulder. How worried should you be about your 401k, your job, about another recession? What's causing all the uncertainty? When will it end, and what do prospects for 2016 look like? Now, for answers, we turn to Mark Vittner and Dr. Harry Bowen. Mark is senior economist and managing director at Wells Fargo. Dr. Harry Bowen is chair of international and business finance in the McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte. Both are with us in our Spirit Square studio, and welcome back to both of you. Good morning.
Good to be here.
Thank you, Mike.
Nice to have you here. In this presidential campaign, we hear from Republicans that the economy is in terrible shape. Is it?
It's in a tough place right now. I think that's pretty evident. I comparatively, the United States is doing better than most countries. The UK may be doing a little bit better than us. But that's not really an overly tough comparison, because global economic growth is close to what we would call a global recession. And growth in the U.S. is only averaged about 2% since the recession ended. And we're much more accustomed to growing between 2.5% to 3%. And 2% growth just isn't enough to provide all that much income growth.
I want to ask you why growth is important a little bit later on, because I think that people don't understand why we have to continually keep growing to keep healthy. According to the president and the Democrats, the other side of that Republican-Democrat coin, the economy is infinitely better than it was in 2008. Industries have been brought back from the brink of extinction. Unemployment is down. Housing sales and home prices are up. Consumers are buying again, although I've read some troubling indicators with regard to automobiles. Car sales, I believe, at the end of last year were the highest ever. Why is there this lingering malaise in the population with this undercurrent of fear about the here and now and the future of where we're going?
Well, I think I could restate that famous line of the man that fell off the top of the building and halfway down said, "So far, so good." So I think that, of course, the political establishment is trying to create an upbeat environment, as is often said that
half of it is.
The general population tends to feel a malaise, and I think sometimes we have short memories. After all, we had went through and are still in a major bubble in terms of property, and that is a deleveraging process that still has not corrected itself. If you look at the studies that came out around the time of that went back historically and looked at episodes such as what we had, it takes a minimum of 8 years and up to 15 years for an economy to fully recover from this kind of deleveraging bubble, and I think Mark hopefully would go along with that.
Put that in English.
Yeah, just simply the idea that what we've gone through in terms of people's balance sheets, right, trying to restore their balance sheets and bring themselves back up to normal levels of spending, and also their outlook. you know, their sentiment, as we would say, has been damaged, and it just takes time to recover. And we've had, of course, other things come along in the same time, and I think Mark can speak to this very well, which has to do with the regulatory environment that has been imposed against the idea of too big to fail. This has required banks to build up large capital reserves. I'd like him to comment a bit on bank lending, how he saw it over the last year and how that's been going. And I think we're still in this process of trying to have an economic adjustment as consumers and the general economy rebuild their balances and feel comfortable enough to be able to go out and spend the way we think, as you indicated at the beginning, back in the 80s and the 90s. And
but we were spending on credit in the 80s and 90s.
Well,
we're building up enormous debt.
That's true. That's true. And also I would say that's part of the China worry, although I think that my own perception is that at the moment no one really knows what's going on. They're trying to divine things from, numbers. Let's say in China, they may or may not believe in the numbers. They see oil prices fall. They can't figure out if that's a demand shock, demand shift, less demand, more demand, or if it's just price effects. I have my own views on that with regard to OPEC.
Because of the nature of the recession and what caused it, today it is my impression that it is, if not harder to get a loan or a mortgage, it is certainly more challenging because they have you jump through a lot more hoops and provide a lot more proof of income and ability to pay back that loan. I don't see anything wrong with that. That seems sensible to me. But most of the provisions, I'm told, of Glass-Steagall, which was supposed to was it Glass-Steagall that was supposed to solve all this,
this? Repeal of Glass-Steagall,
Those provisions haven't even gone into effect yet. They're still deciding what they might be.
I'm not sure. Glass-Steagall was what allowed the banks and investment banks to get back together, and then we had Dodd-Frank, I think.
Dodd-Frank, that's what you're getting at.
In terms of Dodd-Frank and the increased regulation that banks are under right now, they've had to hire a lot of folks in regulatory and compliance areas, mm-hmm. which do not don't help grow the business, and so from a productivity standpoint, that's been a bit of a hit. In terms of qualifying for credit, I do think the pendulum has probably swung a little bit too far, but one of the things that's been very tough for the housing market has been the debt to income requirements, and with so many young people graduating with a lot of student loan debt, they simply aren't in a position to buy a home, and may not be for some time.
But home sales, at least in this market, are rising, as are home prices. So has that had and we are a millennial market. So has that had an impact, really?
Well, we've benefited in Charlotte to a greater degree than the nation has because we've had much stronger population growth. Our population growth is 3 or 4 times stronger than the nation. And we've also seen an influx of retirees that are mainly moving into the South Carolina suburbs. So that's where most of the new single-family construction is.
Is this a boom of apartment construction in Charlotte, is that indicative of people either not wanting to get a loan and buy a house or simply that they can't get the money to buy the house because their credit isn't good enough or they haven't established credit?
It's both.
Or is it just a sea change in the market itself? In other words, were this 2004 and this building boom of residential development was going on, would they be condominiums and not apartments?
Well, they would have been condominiums in the last cycle. I don't think there's as much of a much pressure to own today. It's easier to get financing for apartments.
Right.
And the folks who have been building apartments have been raising a lot of money in the private equity market, and quite frankly, that has some elements of a bubble to it in that the Fed has kept interest rates so low for so long and so many folks are trying to find alternative investments where they can get a little more yield. And so they're going into the private equity market and apartment developers are just flooded with cash. They have so much cash that they feel that they need to build now because they won't always have all that money.
In 2008, the stock market looked like it was going to go to zero. I mean, it was crashing through the floor, and we have recovered from that, and we have been in the longest bull market, I think, in history, or one of the longest in history. And now we're going through a corrective phase, as some people like to call it. Given that the stock market has completely recovered from its losses in 2008, why hasn't the economy?
Well, there's a lot of issues involved with that. I think that that we have a tax policy in the United States that was enacted in the 1980s, before the Berlin Wall came down, before there was an internet. And so it wasn't possible for companies to run for the border and do these inversions. And right now it seems to me that a lot of companies are spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to minimize their tax burdens rather than how to grow their business. We've also seen a dramatic increase in regulation and in the efficacy or the implementation of that regulation has been much more forceful in the wake of the financial crisis.
Is the drive to minimize tax burdens something that is necessary, or it's simply something that businesses want to do because they're so focused on quarterly returns and the bottom line?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with our tax code being outdated. I mean, that we.
What should it be like today?
We should have a more growth-oriented tax code.
How would you encourage
that? How would
you
encourage that? Business investment. We don't tax capital all that much, so I think that we're pretty good on that score. But it needs to be flatter and simpler, and the corporate tax rate needs to be closer to what it is in other countries. We also need to fix immigration. We make it too difficult for highly skilled immigrants to get into the country, and they're not going to come in illegally. And until we do those things, all this cash that's stranded overseas, right, it's not coming back, even if you fix the tax code, even if you give them a tax holiday, because so much of their business is growing overseas. If they can't get the workers they need here in the United States, they're not going to bring the cash back.
Neither of you are political scientists, but this doesn't seem like brain surgery to me, and we've done lots of shows on immigration, and everybody on the left and on the right says our immigration system is broken and needs to be fixed. Many people have talked about fixing taxes. Corporate, the Republicans want to fix the corporate taxes, and Bernie Sanders wants to fix the taxes on individual people. Why can't this make a – why is there no headway at all? None. Zero.
Now, I don't think we'll get any headway till we get past the presidential election and see how it breaks. But I was encouraged that at least from Marco Rubio, you heard an upbeat message. You talked about all the negative messages. At least from him, we got an upbeat message. And I think that there are a lot of people that seem to be really down about the election. Some people even said that's what's bringing the markets down. I've got more faith in the country than this. I think we'll end up with a good result and we'll be just fine.
Well, I wanted to ask about that because it's natural during an election for one party to criticize the other, and particularly the party that's in the White House. You're going to go after them because you want to take back the White House. And in the process of doing that, you're going to talk about how bad everything is. Does that have an impact on the economy? You hear that over and over and over and over on this 24-hour news cycle, and you think, gee, do I really need to buy that car?
Well,
I shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly negative messages are not positive, if I could say it that way. And I think, you know, that, I mean, for example, some of these things to me seem totally unrealistic. If I take Bernie Sanders' desires at face value, all of this, of course, requires Congress in order to either appropriate money or create these incentives to give free college education. I mean, my university is not suddenly going to say, yeah, come, it's free. So this is going to require laws, and the president cannot do that on their own. I mean, we've seen the backlash that has happened just under President Obama in the last few years in terms of executive actions, and as pointed out, he's not the only one that's invoked that privilege. But anyway, so on Bernie Sanders, I think, you know, these kinds of things, I think people realistically look at this, it's just not possible.
That's Dr. Harry Bowen, Chair of International and Business Finance at the McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte. Mark Bittner is also with us, Senior Economist and Managing Director at Wells Fargo. When we come back, we're going to talk about something that when I started doing radio programs, I thought I would never talk about, China. And the impact of China on the world economy, and how that may be affecting what we're going through right now in this country and what it may portend for the future. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Healthy Home Market, a locally grown natural food store with locations in Plaza Midwood, Davidson, and Matthews. Details available at healthyhomemkt.com. Siri, Cortana, you know them, don't you? Google Now, they've all become part of most people's lives. They're kind of, well, they are not kind of like, they are digital assistants. Artificial intelligence, in essence, robots. Now, we have automated call centers that we're accustomed to having to use, although we don't like it very much. They understand us, but they infuriate us. Airports have those ticket kiosks, so you don't have to talk to an agent. cars will soon drive themselves. We are quickly developing a second intelligent species, one that Marshall Brain warns could soon eliminate jobs in startling numbers. And we hear from him talking about the economy. We'll hear from him tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Puerto Rico's governor has warned for months that the U.S. territory is in a debt spiral with its crushing $72 billion debt, Puerto Rico's financial crisis, and new actions being considered by the White House and Congress.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the economy today with two economists, Mark Vittner with Wells Fargo and Dr. Harry Bowen with the Queen's University of Charlotte and the McCall School of Business. China is often cited as one of the drivers of uncertainty on Wall Street. Their economy appears to be slowing down, and the figures on the health of the Chinese economy come from the Chinese government. Not the most trustworthy source for a number of reasons. So things may actually be worse than they appear to be. Of course, they may not be. Why does the market care? Do we sell that much to China? Are we that heavily invested in China?
Well, initially, when China devalued the yuan back in August, we had a big sell-off in the stock market. And the official word from the Federal Reserve, the Wall Street Journal, everybody said, hey, wait a minute, China's not that important. U.S. exports to China account for just 0.6% of our GDP. Exports in total are only about 14% of our GDP. Everybody tried to minimize it. And I think that was a huge mistake. China is much more important than people realize. And merely looking at the direct effects, I think, misses so much of the story. It's the indirect effects. It's always the contagion that causes a lot of damage. And I think that what's really unsettled the markets is that it's very unclear as to how much China's economy has slowed. They say they grew 6.8% over the last year, yet steel production has fallen in each of the last 3 years. Railroad car loadings are down. Electricity consumption's down. These sorts of things do not happen in an economy growing 6.8%.
In January, the Washington Post said that the Chinese economy was grinding down to 3 or 4% from 6 or 7%. We're growing at 2%. That sounds healthy to me.
Well, it's all about the base. In terms of China, the base that growth is taking place on is much smaller, so the percentage gains look a little faster. Growth at less than 5% is not enough to provide meaningful wages and employment opportunities for all the young people that are coming of age in China. And on top of that, the slowdown, I mean, I think it's worse than that. I think they're probably headed to 2% growth, worse than what the Post says. And in a developing economy, that's going to create a lot of difficulty. But where we've seen the contagion effect is that it's weakened commodity prices, not just oil, but oil being one of the more prominent ones. It's also weakened the
currency. Because there's less of a demand for oil in China now?
Because there's less demand.
And for everything, commodities.
And while China's growth was ramping up, there was a lot of investment in quarries and mines in the energy business and in agriculture, all built on this notion that China's economy was going to continue to grow rapidly, and that their wealth, the average Chinese family's wealth, would converge with that of developed countries. Well, now that's all been set back, and so everything that's been tied to China's emergence is now in reverse.
Well, we are this is a really stupid question because you're an economist and this probably seems elementary to you, but we got along just fine without China for most of the 20th century. Why do we need them now?
Well, I think, you know, they have been a major source of a potential new market, okay, for our companies trying to go into China to sell more. The other thing, of course, has been the structural changes that occurred and the strategies that firms pursued starting in the 80s, really, with what that period we call globalization, where the world just burst open in terms of truly global competition. and companies were forced to try to find alternative places in which they could conduct activity to keep costs down. So, for example, you're competing with Japan. If Japan advantage is based, let's say, on low labor costs, or you go to other countries where low labor costs are low, and then our companies here are trying to compete with that, they can either try to improve in terms of technology, gain cost advantages that way, and if not, they decide that they will either import those cheaper goods or they will construct factories overseas. And that's what happened with China and Southeast Asia.
I would bet you that the average American is thinking, well, you know, pre-globalization, we had it pretty good over here. We made decent money. The factories were roaring, then we globalized and everything went to hell.
Yeah,
why do we care? Why don't we just retract?
Well, we can't. I think you make an interesting point, and I think it kind of goes to Mark's point too. And that has to do with the sort of the role of China in the world, the United States, the way things have really changed. You know, as we know, after World War II, the United States sat in a unique position in terms of being the only economy that had no damaged factories and capital equipment. We rapidly evolved from a military-producing economy into a consumer economy. We provided Europe with washing machines and all sorts of other things, and we were doing very well. We had a kind of, I won't call it monopoly, but a unique position. And the same thing has sort of happened with regard to China. China became suddenly this big engine of demand in the global economy in terms of commodities, oil, you know, all the basic things. And as China has reached a kind of limitation on the rate at which it can grow, which is an expected event actually, its demand has slackened. And I think, as Mark had pointed out, a lot of the stock market reaction, China is kind of a secondary signal. It's like taking your temperature. And so much of Chinese growth was driven by the Chinese government's investment policy that they tried to relax that, allow Chinese consumers to take up some of the slack, and I think they're not doing it. And so the big concern is, when is the Chinese government going to step in, or are they, and pump more money in and infrastructure projects? And because the minute that we saw, I think it was about, Mark, 3-6 months ago, when the Chinese government suddenly started to expand its monetary policy to create some easing, the stock market jumped.
Yeah.
And so we're in this kind of thing like a housing bubble where we're relying on government generosity, in China's case, to sort of fuel a lot of this demand. And I think people are very uncertain how much of this is real and how much is government policy.
Milton Friedman might have another word for generosity when it refers to money creation.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
He might call that greed. But
China has a lot of U.S. debt. They hold a lot of our debt. What impact does their economic slowdown have on that, if any?
Well, one of the things that we've seen is that China apparently has been selling U.S. treasuries. They're a big holder of U.S. treasuries. And that actually caused interest rates to rise slightly at the start of the year. I don't know if the selling has slowed or just worries about the economy have helped bring down rates. It hasn't just been the Chinese. The Saudis are also running about a 20% budget deficit right now. And so they've been selling. Both the Chinese and the Saudis and sovereign wealth funds throughout Asia have also been selling stocks, particularly big blue chip name stocks that are highly liquid. And it's contributed to some of the sell-off in the stock market.
China wants to decouple it. I don't understand any of this, but they want to decouple their currency from the dollar. And they have, as you said, devalued the yuan against other currencies. Why? What does that do for them?
Well, I think that this goes to a broader sort of goal on the part of the nations of the world to suggest to China that it needs to have a more market-oriented or market-determined exchange rate. China, to this point, has been one of the only countries in the world that still tries to fix the value of its currency. And part of this goes also to their desire to include themselves in the International Monetary Fund's definition of the currency they create. And so the rest of the world is telling China, we would like you – and partly I would say that this is because many people have the belief that the Chinese currency is being held at too low a value and that this creates unfair competition and these other kinds of words. But I think they would like China to be a more normal market-based economy.
And doesn't China want to have their currency of equal importance in the world to the U.S. dollar?
Right, and that's that. Those two things are tied together. So in order to create credibility in the Chinese currency, because in a sense they would like other people to hold their currency like people do the dollar, a so-called reserve currency, the nations are saying, well, in order to be credible, you have to have a market-determined exchange rate. So China has certainly have people within China in the monetary authorities that would like to move to a more market-determined rate.
Do they have the tools, the knowledge, or the political ability to do what needs to be done to shore up their economy? This is a communist country.
Yes,
they're
and
not
no.
capitalists.
Yes, yes, and no.
Okay. Right.
You know, they certainly have the knowledge. You know, I think, of course, the political element cannot be minimized in terms of what China does. And so they're very cautious with regard to what's going on. People, the political apparatus does not – feels very uncertain about releasing control. They've been in a controlled environment since 1949, and it's really hard. It's kind of like letting your kids leave the house, I guess. Something like that.
It's awfully
they're helicopter parents.
Exactly.
but it's awfully tough to control these mammoth currency flows.
Yeah.
And I had some sympathy for China as their economy was growing. Everybody wanted to invest in China. That would have pushed the value of their currency up to such high levels that they wouldn't be competitive. And now that folks are frightened, everybody wants to get out of China. So currency's trying that would lead to a much weaker currency. Yeah. They're trying to manage the process as best they can, but unfortunately, that goes away from having a market determined currency. And there's very mixed messages coming out of China. We see huge billion-dollar purchases. Higher buying GE's appliance division. Another firm is bidding for Terex and maybe Syngenta in Sweden, Switzerland. At the same time, we hear that they're making it tougher for folks to get tourist visas to come to the U.S. because they're trying to discourage people from coming here and buying homes. So which seems like small potatoes compared to the investments that we're seeing, like Volvo, which is a Chinese-owned firm building a car factory in South Carolina. I mean, that's at least $500 million.
Volvo is a Chinese-owned firm. When did that happen?
Now,
well, it was American-owned before. It was Swedish, then American, right. And then after the financial crisis, sold to the Chinese.
It's also part of the problem, the fact that the Chinese economy probably does have a big impact on the Asian economy and the Asian stock markets. Is that part of the problem as well?
Certainly they're big in terms of a buyer of things and also a seller. So they are competitors to their fellow nations in Southeast Asia. So there's concerns on the part of the smaller nations with regard to China's exchange rate policy, for example, how that affects their relative competitiveness. And, of course, you have a whole geopolitical thing that's been going on for, you know, decades in that area. And I think that as China has grown and it has sought to extend its sphere of influence, that this has, made many of its neighbors wary as to what its intentions are.
But the problems here aren't just in China, although Greece and the monetary problems in Greece.
Yeah, whatever happened to Greece?
Well, I was going to say, monetary problems in Greece and Spain and other places in Europe have been relatively quiet for a while. The European stock market and the European economy seems to be challenged at the moment. What's going on there, and why are they still having troubles?
Well, after the terrorist attacks in France, we saw the French economy really pull back, similar in ways that we saw the U.S. pull back after 9/11. A lot of people stayed home, so consumer spending was off. Growth in Europe has been sluggish at best. The U.K. is certainly an island unto itself, and it has done very, very well, followed a different set of policies, has its own currency. And the continent is struggling. I mean, it is We've also had this wave of immigrants, which some people looked at as being a positive, and it could be at some point in the future. But right now, when you're absorbing hundreds of thousands of low-skilled workers that don't speak the language, it's a bit of a burden, and it certainly has been a costly burden, and it's diverted resources at a time where the economy's been struggling. So it's hard to find any bright spots in Europe right now, but it's not in a crisis either. So they're just kind of plodding along. Where the real deterioration has taken place in the global economy are countries that have commodity-based economies, big commodity exporters like Brazil, Australia, and Canada. And so now we're beginning to get to some major trading partners of the U.S. And you could even throw Russia in that group. And so that affects our agriculture sector, our mining sector, certainly the energy sector, and export-oriented manufacturing. Altogether, that's about 30% of our economy. And while, you know, I hate to say a part of our economy is in recession, there's 30% of our economy that is declining, where output is declining right now.
Hmm. Yeah, and I would also point out that certainly for Europe, China is a much more important customer to them than China is to us. So again, if you get this follow-on contagion type of an effect, if earnings in Europe are not doing very well, if China is truly slowing down, then that generally means that there's less demand that can come to us.
China is our fastest growing customer in North Carolina. And really? South Carolina's largest export market. So it's our third largest export market. It's our fastest growing export market. I believe it was the eighth largest 4 years ago. It's third today. I think they were the 10th largest in South Carolina. They're number one today. And so there is some significance here. And the Chinese have a number of significant investments in South Carolina. The Haier's got a refrigerator plant in Camden. We've got the Volvo factory, and then we've got the Kiel. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. It's a new yarn plant, cotton yarn plant that's just outside of Charlotte, just across Pageland.
Mm-hmm. The other big factor that everybody talks about is oil. Yesterday, the Dow ended down another 300 points because of oil prices. Evidently, as oil goes, so goes the market. Why are the two so closely related? There aren't that many oil stocks on the market, aside from ExxonMobil and a few others, especially at a time when alternative forms of energy are on the rise. Why are we so tied to oil on the stock market?
Again, you need to look at the contagion effects. And, you know, the energy sector was responsible for a lot of U.S., a large portion of U.S. growth from 2010 to 2014, which is, and then prices began to come down in the latter part of 2014. Texas, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Colorado, those four states accounted for 30% of our GDP growth from 2010 to 2014.
And you were telling me in the break that Houston,
yes,
just the city of Houston accounted for how much?
Houston, the metropolitan area of Houston, accounted for 17% of U.S. GDP growth all by itself.
It's unbelievable.
And it matches up. It's the number one housing market, strongest population growth, strongest job growth. The largest export market for the U.S. Mm-hmm. is Houston. And all of those things happened. So with energy now contracting, folks are wondering, well, what does that mean? The energy sector probably accounted for one-third of U.S. GDP growth from 2010 to 2014. What's going to replace that?
But it wasn't that long ago when we were complaining about $5 a gallon gasoline, and now it's back under $2 a gallon. And I remember when it was there before thinking, you know, golly, $1.89 a gallon is pretty high.
So why now?
If we got along just fine when gasoline was $1.89 a gallon in 1970, why isn't it fine now?
Well, it's a short-term and a longer-term effect. The short-term effect is that all that growth in production is gone, or it's no longer a source of growth. I mean, we're still producing a lot of oil, but it's no longer growing.
Let me stop you. We'll start over with that question in a second because we only have 10 seconds left, and you're not going to be able to finish that. That's Mark Vintner from Wells Fargo. Dr. Harry Bowen is with us from Queen's University of Charlotte, and we are coming right back to talk more about oil and get your impressions of the economy as well. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Leading Results, providing B2B companies with marketing strategy and services for website development, lead generation, and inbound marketing in the greater Charlotte area. Details at leadingresults.com/WFAE. Puerto Rico's governor has warned for months that the U.S. territory is in a death spiral with its crushing $72 billion debt. On the Diane Rehm Show today at 10 o'clock, you can join them for a discussion about Puerto Rico's financial crisis and new actions being considered by the White House and Congress. That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And we are coming right back.
This week, the hosts of All Things Considered are on the road. In New Hampshire,
it is a different Republican electorate, and so it's pretty much a different ballgame.
California,
we're standing probably about as close as we can legally get to the side of the gas leak.
And Flint, Michigan.
Can you do that day after day for months or years?
As long as they send the water, yes. We'll be here to pass it out.
All Things Considered takes you beyond the headlines. Listen every afternoon.
All Things Considered, weekday afternoons beginning at 4 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins in our Spirit Square studio with Mark Vintner, Senior Economist and Managing Director at Wells Fargo, and Dr. Harry Bowen, the Chair of the International and Business Finance Department, or I guess it's a department, at the McCall School of Business. McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte. So I've asked why, if $1.89 a gallon was great when the economy was chugging along in the 1970s and 60s, why it's not great today.
Well, and the short answer is that the loss of production, the exploration and production, that loss of investment on that end hurts us today. And so we see those layoffs up front. And the savings from lower gasoline prices, they gradually accrue over time. So we use twice as much oil as we produce in the United States. So lower oil prices will be a good thing for our economy eventually. It's just right now the negative effects of lower gas prices are overwhelming the positives. Mm-hmm.
The oil companies have made record profits in recent years. When they were making, and they're on hard times now because of the investment in technology that's not being used because they backed off a lot of fracking now because there's oversupply of oil. But when they were making record profits, were they driving the stock market up as they are driving it down now during their worry years?
Well, they were participating in the run-up. And let me tell you something about the oil business. Exxon and Chevron and BP and Conoco did not really participate in this fracking boom. They've had very little to do with it. The companies that doubled U.S. oil productions, well, they were mid-sized and smaller oil companies, independent oil exploration and production companies, people like EOG, Devon Resources.
Who then sell the oil to ExxonMobil?
Well, they may have their own distribution as well, but they're selling it out into the market. But many of these companies, not necessarily the ones I named, but many of the companies that are in this category are highly levered, meaning they borrowed tons of money. They have to continue to produce regardless of what the price is. As long as the price of oil is above the marginal cost of getting it out of the ground, they're going to keep producing so they can stay current on their debts.
Hmm. And so you said off the air a minute ago that we haven't seen the bottom, and you're going to tell us how we'll know when we're at the bottom.
I don't know where prices will eventually bottom. I do think it'll be much lower. But in the past, when we have gone through a time like this where we have been tremendously oversupplied, and that's the issue with the market right now, prices have tended to drop to the marginal cost of the most efficient producer. And then all the least efficient producers go out of business. And so you see a big increase in bankruptcies. You see the stronger companies buying the weaker companies and some consolidation among the stronger companies. You think back to the 1990s when oil fell to $9 a barrel. That's when Exxon bought Mobil. That's when Chevron bought Texaco and BP bought Amoco.
What is the price of a barrel of oil right now?
It was about $30, something like that.
And off the air, you were talking about the price.
Yeah, I had done a little homework. So in 1970, it would cost $1.21. And the equivalent price in 2015 money.
Wait a minute. The price of a barrel of oil was $1.21?
$1.21, yeah. I remember filling up for 28 cents.
Yeah, so do I.
The equivalent price in today's dollars, 2015 dollars, would be about $7.40. So thinking of Mark's idea that oil has probably not hit bottom is I think we have roughly, because somewhere between 12 and 12, 15, $18 a barrel. If and this is the big if OPEC is unable to get its act together and restrict production, oil production, in order to raise prices. I think, we all have short memories in some ways. We look at these very high prices of oil in the last few years, but if you go back in 1970, a barrel of oil cost $27.60.
Yeah.
So it's really been since the financial crisis that we've had this run-up. And I think a couple of factors there are certainly the Middle East. The uncertainty related to supply, these kinds of issues, and that doesn't look like it's going away. And in fact, one could wonder, why is it that OPEC, and in particular Saudi Arabia, is having such a hard time getting its members around the idea of production quotas in order to rein in supply and get the price back up.
I read yesterday it's because they have too many competitors now. Yeah. They used to be the king. Now they're not the king anymore.
They used to be what was known as the swing producer, meaning that they could expand or contract production by themselves and influence the price. Mm-hmm. Most of the growth in global oil production has taken place here in the United States. That's
right.
Where most of the growth has taken place. And so that they have very little influence over that. And then on top of that, you have Iran, Iran and the Saudis are geopolitical competitors. I don't see why they would want to reduce their production to allow Iran to increase theirs. And Iran is has the second largest oil reserves in the Middle East.
So I think are we partly to blame?
It's motives. Nobody can really understand exactly the motives here. And it just goes, I think, to the general climate of uncertainty that we're feeling and the volatility that's showing up in stock markets and the difficulty in.
So are we partly to blame for this? We kind of shook up the Middle East with our invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the dominoes that began to fall over there. And now we're into fracking and producing our own oil. So we've increased our control, increased the supply. Mm-hmm. China's demand is lowering. Is that what's going on?
I don't know that I would place blame. I think it's a good thing that we are now more energy independent than we were in the past. I think that in the case of Iran coming offline, I mean, that was because of – they had sanctions put in place on Iran that was due to their behavior and their pursuit of a nuclear program. So I don't know that had we not had the war in Iraq and Iraq continued to pump oil, oil prices may not have gotten as high as they did in the last cycle.
Oil has a history of boom and bust, as I understand it. And in the old days, when oil was going through a bust period, it didn't really affect our employment picture all that much because it was all being pumped elsewhere. Now it's being pumped out of the ground in as you mentioned, North Dakota and places in Texas, and everybody wants to get into the fracking business to bring the oil out of the ground. So when things go bust, we lose jobs. How many jobs have we lost, and what kind of an impact does that have on our economy?
We haven't lost as many as you'd think because the energy business now is so capital intensive. I think Texas is still adding jobs. Even Houston had a small gain in employment in 2015. I do think they'll lose jobs now because the industry is now recognize that prices are going to remain lower for longer. But there's one key difference in this cycle and previous cycles, and that is we have more oil and natural gas in the ground. So there's still a lot of investment in petrochemical plants along the Gulf Coast. The growth of petrochemical plants last year accounted for 15% of all business investment in the United States.
A Reuters poll revealed that 75% of respondents have used the extra savings they're getting from low gasoline prices to cover basic needs and not to buy big-ticket items, which is what they used to do. They used to go out and buy gas-guzzling cars when the price of gas went down. Is that a comment about the wisdom of the American consumer, or is it a comment about the state of consumers in this economy and the stagnating middle class?
Yeah, I would actually say that it kind of comes back to something I said a while back, and that had to do with the hangover effects that we have had since this financial crisis. So right there, you're giving me some anecdotal evidence that people do not feel that this windfall they're getting by lower gas prices, makes it that we can suddenly go out and splurge, that in fact they're using it to replace and build back their, as we would say, balance sheets, their sort of economic strength. And so, you know, I think it's not that people don't want to buy and don't want to spend. They just still don't have not built up the sort of cushion of balances and comfort that where they can feel they can do it.
And one thing that's changed, and this feeds right into this, is that home equity loans that were written 10 years ago at the height of the housing bubble are now converting where for the first 10 years, you only had to make interest payments. You didn't have to make any principal payments.
Right.
And now folks are having to make those principal payments. And so you would say, well, gosh, folks are saving it. Well, paying back debt is a form of saving, but it doesn't really give you
doesn't increase firepower.
It doesn't really increase spending power that much, at least not in the near term.
So on social media, we asked, what are your thoughts about the rocky economic road? And Bill from Matthews has written in, could you make a comparison between today's stock market economy and that of the mid-70s? The last time oil was below $30 a barrel, back then a gallon of regular gas was selling for 36 cents. Wouldn't you love that? What about the coal industry in this new economy?
Yeah. I think coal is in danger, both for political reasons and also for, generally the idea of wanting to move toward more cleaner sources of fuel. And I think that we obviously, view oil as important because especially as everyday consumers, it comes to us in the form of either heating oil or gasoline. But at the industrial level, I think that while oil is important and coal too, it's really the natural gas that is the future here. I was reading recently in The Economist about how the global market for LNG, liquefied natural gas, is only starting to really start to gel. And this has to do with building infrastructure in different places and getting markets to work better. And I think that this may end up being the thing that propels liquid natural gas even more. Mm. So I would say that coal will probably still be around. I think Mark can say something about this too, but I see other sources of fuel coming on board.
I think coal will continue to decline as a share of our energy use, but a lot of people think it'll be dead and gone. I don't think it'll be dead and gone. People thought the oil business was dead and gone.
Yeah.
What really brought back the oil business were advances in technology, and I don't know what they are because I'm not an engineer, but I'm willing to bet that in 25 to 30 years, we'll find ways to burn coal perfectly cleanly or to convert it into some other fuel.
Peggy writes, I keep reading about a looming student debt bubble bursting. What do your guests think?
I don't think a bubble's going to burst the way that the student loan system works right now. The debts really follow you for the rest of your life, so there's not really a bubble to burst. But at some point, the growth in student loans is going to be seen as being unsustainable. And so I think that where that will fall back on is some of the growth that we've seen in the university system will begin to slow. And we won't see all of these mega dorms. The students today live better than the faculty did when I went to school.
Alex on Facebook, the Federal Reserve reduces interest rates, the stock market does well. The Fed raises rates, and the stock market does poorly. That is the single biggest reason why Wall Street is doing poorly now. Do you agree with that?
I don't think it's the single biggest reason, but when the Fed raised rates in December, they did something that no Fed had ever done before. They raised interest rates at a time where the manufacturing side of the economy was contracting. And in the past, when the ISM manufacturing index had fallen below 50, the Fed had deemed it that important that they cut interest rates every time that had happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And this time they raised them. So I think that we're in uncharted waters. The last interest rate hike that they did, and the market actually rose that day, I think has raised more questions about what the Fed's reaction function is going to be in the future, and it's increased uncertainty.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, people just – and the Fed included, they just really do not have a clue exactly where we are. It's kind of like being in a big fog and we can't quite figure out the direction that the ship is going. They're watching various indicators. I think that generally the most recent things that I've read indicate that based on futures prices and whatever, the market generally believes that the Fed now will be unlikely to raise interest rates at most once in the next year.
We only have a few minutes left, and I want to spend some time talking about the disappearing middle class. For 70 years, we have lived in a consumer-driven economy in this country, primarily middle-class consumers making purchases on washing machines and houses and cars and stereos and trips because they could, because they made enough money to do that. Now middle-class wages have stagnated. If the rich keep getting richer and the poor and the middle class find it difficult to make ends meet, can we have a consumer economy? Is that sustainable?
Well, I think it, and I'd mentioned this before, I don't think the middle class is disappearing. I think the middle class is stagnating, in that there's so many pressures that are coming on middle class. For starters, the typical housing value for a middle class family hasn't appreciated, so they haven't seen the rise in wealth that we read about in the papers. When we hear that housing prices have gone up, they've mainly gone up in areas close to the inner city and some of the higher priced parts of the country, not in middle class neighborhoods. The cost of health care, the out of pocket cost of health care, have risen much faster than wages. The cost of rents, if they rent, has risen much faster than wages. And the cost of higher education has risen much faster than wages. So the middle class has really gotten squeezed in the last few decades. They're still there. They're just getting squeezed, and they have less discretionary income.
What do you see for the year, for the rest of the year? Good growth, bad growth, no growth, a recession? What do you see?
I see slow growth. They just came out with the numbers for the last quarter of 2015. I think their initial estimate is 0.9% growth, 0.7%. That'll get revised as the months go along, and generally the revisions will bump that up a little bit. We'll have to see. But I think with the general, at least at the moment, forecasters have been reducing their forecasts for world growth. We've already talked about how China's growth may not be what we think it is. And I think that there's just real concern going forward in this economy as to what profits are going to be, how that's going to affect the stock market. I think we're slow.
Dr. Harry Bowen is chair of the International Business Finance Division at McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte. Mark Vittner, senior economist, managing director of Wells Fargo. I'll give you the 20 seconds for the last word here.
Well, our forecast is for a little bit slower growth. We're just under 2% for 2016. And I wouldn't say the odds of a recession are zero, but they are fairly low. I'd say around 30%.
Wow. Okay. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte talks with